Good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
And I'm Nate. I'm an alcoholic.
And Nate.
Why don't we start with a moment of silence and call upon the power that got us here and keeps us here. In the Serenity Prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So nice to be in Conyers, Georgia, with you guys. So we're going to talk about the first step here, and I believe that for some of our contributions, we did a lot of that last night. But I do want to say, let's just put one on the table you do not have to agree with. But it's interesting that in many cases, the drugs that people ingest are addictive. And my opinion is that I'm addicted to a non-addictive substance. 9 out of 10 people can drink alcohol with more or less impunity. But 1 out of 10 people has an allergy to this particular ethyl alcohol that will kick us right into the grave or into the jail or into the insane asylum. I just throw that out there for your contemplation. As I say, you don't have to agree with it. But what it reinforces for me is that this disease is not in the bottle. And I think that's critical to my recovery. This disease is not in the bottle. So that if I put that bottle down and I think I'm safe, I'm in for a rude awakening. Because that disease is constantly out, as we say, in the parking lot doing push-ups. It will never stop. I will never in my life be free of alcoholism. Which brings up the hidden agenda. And we'll talk about the hidden agenda hopefully through the weekend. The hidden agenda is I'm going to work steps until. Now, the reason it's called hidden is we may not know that we're carrying that loaded gun. Let's take an example where someone wants to be married. And they come into the Boys and Girls Campus of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're a pistol. Man, they are working steps. They are rocking and rolling. Until they find him or her, and they've achieved their agenda. And then what happens to their program? What happens to their program? It starts to go down like this because they've worked to get that. So another one I can bring up, and I'm going to misquote the book, it is the great obsession of every abnormal thinker to do the right about face and think like a gentleman. That's a hidden agenda. I'm going to work this program until alcoholism goes away. And then I'm going to experience all this frustration and upset because alcoholism's not going away and I think I'm flunking. So we talk in here, if you want what we have and you're willing to go at any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Well, what do we have? I can tell you what I have is I have a response to a deadly disease. I have alcoholism and it comes for me every morning like a vulture on the foot of the bed. Good morning, Mickey. We're going to do it again, brother. If I do not turn to God and I do not work my steps, that vulture will have me. This is going to be Merry Sunshine Weekend. Happy, joyous, and free is fine, and we can talk about that as well. But if I turn my back on this disease, it'll eat me whole. Because while I'm paying attention here, that disease is advancing here. It's always like that. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That means I have no power right now, 42 years into this, to stay away from the first drink. I have no power for that. It has to be given to me by God. And the book, when we came in here, did they not tell us, the people we were with, you have a 1-day reprieve from alcoholism. you have a death sentence that's been executed here and you have a one-day reprieve. We go, yeah, I get it. You had a one-day reprieve. And we go on and live our lives like that's not true. My forgetter is better than my rememberer. Okay? I can't stay away from it on my own. I can't control it when it's in my body. I was 10 years sober and I had a job interview. And it was at this lunch, and my wife and I have a picture of us that hangs in our on a wall in our home, and it's a picture of us that I found in a thrift store. And it's a little boy and a little girl dressed up in mom and dad's clothes shopping for flowers. And that's who went 10 years sober to that job interview, that little boy in his dad's clothes. And so I open the menu for lunch, and I see Moosey's Swiss, non-alcoholic Swiss beer. I'm going, wait a minute. I haven't had a beer in 10 years. That's what I drank mostly is beer. And then I would drink ethyl alcohol in any form after I got a little smoother. And I thought, well, it says non-alcoholic, man, I'm in. This is a job interview. I order the beer. This is, I got sober in 70. So this is now 84, and I'm drinking my beer, and I can see the lady who's interviewing me. I can see her lips moving, and I'm thinking, man, I must be having a hysterical reaction. It said on the menu this is non-alcoholic, right? Well, we have more information now, but I didn't have any of that information, and plus I had a major case of stupid going on. So I finished that beer, and I had a couple of reactions. My wife's not alcoholic, but if you give my wife any alcohol, her nose and her face turn bright red. So that's, I mean, a visible clue that there's alcohol present. So I called her up, and I said, you know, I just had this experience. I got to believe I'm just having a hysterical reaction. And so I said, I'm going to get a couple more beers, and I'm going to come home, and we're going to sit, and we're going to drink together, and here we go. And my second reaction was, this stuff is great. I'm going to get a case of it. Less of 0.5% alcohol is in that bottle, and it kicked my disease into gear. So I am like deadly allergic to this thing that 9 out of 10 people can drink more or less okay. That's where I am on the first half of the first step. So if the disease is not in the bottle, and again, nobody speaks for AA. Nobody's carrying the flag for AA. So what I have to say, if it doesn't jive with this big book, you disregard it, if you want to. If the disease is not in the bottle, then where is it? It's in me. It's in me. It's in my being. That my life had become unmanageable. So I'd like to take us through a partial laundry list of what unmanageability is. So on page 52, and what I'd like to do is I'm going to go through these bedevilments, we call them, and I'm going to pause on each one, and I'd like us to just take a moment and ask ourselves, where am I with this right now? I'll preface it by saying this, and this, I believe, can be the context for our weekend. Above the bedevilments, it says, is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new, by the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or gadget which does not work for something new which does? We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. I don't know what an Earth person's reaction would be to this list. Okay? But we'll see what our reaction is. We were having trouble with personal relationships. I have never met an alcoholic in my life who could not answer yes to that. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. we were a prey to misery and depression. If you've ever watched a college football game or an NFL football game, you'll get an appreciation of what prey means. So if you see the defensive lineman, when the ball is snapped in slow motion, going after that quarterback, you'll understand who's the predator and who's the prey. And their job at 300 pounds is to kill that guy. We were a prey to misery and depression. And isn't it interesting now in these days that we will say to one another, man, I am really depressed. I better get some medicine. Now, look, if we legitimately need medicine for a clinical situation going, fair enough. But the fact that we're suffering depression is not an indication that we've now flunked AA and we have now flunked working our program. This comes along. The things I'm reading here and that they've written for us, notice it didn't say for some of us we'll have this. Or when hungover, we will have these things. Or when drinking, we have these things. This is right with the disease. This is the disease of alcoholism. I call it a partial laundry list. I'm sure we could add to it. We couldn't make a living. Oh, no, I can make a living. This is the one where we pull. I can make a living, man. I go to work every day. Who gives you the power to show up for that job every day? And have you had the opposite experience of being unable to go to work that day? I'm not talking about when you're hungover. I'm talking about when the air's out of the tires. And you can't go to work because you just can't do it. And would most normal, whatever that means, people consider getting out of bed a heroic act? Is it not true for some of us or for many of us at some time or other that getting out of bed is a heroic act? Because here we go again, right? We got to go out and live this day. My problem is not my drinking. My problem is I don't know how to live sober. I do not know how to live sober. What's it mean? When I got sober, they had Welch's grape jelly glasses. You know, and you could, for kids, and you could eat the grape jelly and then you'd have a glass. And they had Archie and Jughead characters on it, which may or not mean something to people here, but they had this weird thing printed on the glass. It stopped me, and I've obviously never forgotten it. It said, "Friends are for sharing." I looked at that and I thought, man, everybody knows friends are for using. We had a feeling of uselessness. Another reason for not getting out of bed. We were full of fear. Wouldn't it be lovely if that was a used to was statement? Right? And how many of us go around full of fear? Now, we're not going to talk about it. That's another key piece to this thing. Because, as I mentioned last night, we are competitive animals. I'm not going to tell somebody I am full of fear because I just flunked AA. But it may be true. And it's okay to talk about it. And as a matter of fact, if we do talk about it, it can help us to carry that burden. We were unhappy. It doesn't sound like much, does it? We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. So I told you I had a loaded gun in my top drawer of my dresser. Now, my wife had to carry that burden too, you understand? She knew that her husband had a loaded gun in his top drawer. And I wasn't kidding. And I heard you talk in your meetings, and you talked about alcohol and alcohol and alcohol until I got into despair. I thought, oh my God, is that the litmus test for me getting well? do I have to, so let's like say this guy drank so much that he peeled himself off a steam pipe that he'd been holding on to in the winter to keep from freezing to death, and he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now we're going to make him president, right? Because he abused this thing and himself so severely that he's now got major chops. Do you see what I'm saying? And we go, wow, that guy's really got it going on. And I'm sitting there wanting to blow my brains out, and I think, okay, what anonymous do I go to now, please? Seriously, what anonymous do I go to? And I got a sponsor in that group that I told you about. The sponsor I chose, somebody asked me earlier who my sponsor was, and I forgot that I had John for a while, but I asked this guy because he was a little guy. Now, God has this enormous sense of humor. I got him because he was this little guy with a burr haircut, and I thought I could steamroller him. And I come from an all-military family, and I was really having survivor's guilt because I did not fight in Vietnam, and my family went and fought. My dad fought in World War II. My brothers fought in Vietnam. I had bad hinges. My knees did not allow me to get in. As a matter of fact, the Army operated on my knees because I was a dependent. So I had all the proof in the world that was not for me, but I could not accept it. So I got George. And George was this little guy who had just served three tours in Vietnam as a Navy medic attached to the Marines. I'm going to steamroller George. And I'd go over and see George, and he had a picture on the back of his door of what he used to look like. He'd lost 100 pounds. And George would counsel me. He was studying to become a Methodist minister. He'd had all the war he wanted. And he'd give me Weight Watchers cookies and ice cream, and he said, "It's okay, Mickey. It has vitamins in it." I was 6'3 and 145 pounds. If I took my shirt off, you could count my ribs across the street. I didn't come in here in fit physical condition. And I would talk to George, and I would talk to George, and he would say to me, "Mickey, it's always darkest before the dawn." And I would call George on the phone, and I'd say, "George, is it almost dawn?" And they told me there was a God, you know, and I'd lost my God. So anyway, I went over to see George one day. I'll tell you my cheese sandwich story. So I had my brown bag. I was working close to where George lived, and I went over to talk to him, and I started to talk to him, and I'm not telling George anything new. I'm so angry that nobody will work with me at work. They don't want to be around me. I am cheating on my wife. I'm suicidal. I'm not having a great day. And George has heard all this before, and he was very kind, and he stood up and he says, "You know, Mickey, when I got where you are," he said, "I got down on my knees and I asked God from the bottom of my heart for help." And he stood up and he said, "And you can use my apartment," and he left. Now I'm in George's apartment by myself, and he said he got on his knees and I got on my knees. And I got on my knees and I didn't have a God. And the only prayer I had was, "Will somebody please help me?" And I got up and I left, and an hour later I went back to work and I called George on the phone and I said, "George, I have one question for you." And he said, "All right." I said, "Do I do the things I do and think the things I think because I'm alcoholic?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Can I recover from the way I live?" And he said, "Yes." And there's a line in the family afterwards that Father, like a gaunt prospector, with his belt drawn in over his last ounce of food, his pick strikes gold. And I came up off the sidewalk about as high as this table is from the floor. I could not believe what he just told me, because now I'm going to read your line on 52. After the bedevilments, it says this. I'm telling you, I had just spent months in AA listening to alcohol. Listen, alcohol would kill me, all right? I'm not putting that down. But I'd been listening to alcohol forever. And I read the most important plural word I've ever seen in my life in what I'm about to read you. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. Check this out. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment, not that they flew. They had faith that they could. And it kicked the thing in gear. I grabbed everybody I could get my hands on in York Street, and I told them, alcoholism is a disease and we can recover from it, like everybody knew it, but me. I had recovered from what I thought alcoholism was. Am I beating this thing enough in the floor for you? But I thought I was alcoholic and I was crazy. I thought I was alcoholic and I was suicidal. I didn't understand if you're alcoholic, like a guy finally told me, you're alcoholic from the top of your head, Mickey, to the tip of your toes. Everything about you is alcoholic. Which means if we work a program on alcoholism, everything about us can get better. This is good news. Now, the first step is like, seems like a condemnation, a death sentence. Well, it is. But it's a death to our false self, not to our true being. That's another theme for the weekend. So, I'm going to turn it over to Nate here in a moment, but I told George, I said, George, if God lets me live, I will never shut up about the second half of the first step my entire life. Because if this isn't good news, if we're talking about recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're talking about recovery of our lives. What does it mean? Man, I've been married for 45 years. I was useless in a relationship. I was so self-centered. And I've got a shot to be married. I've got a shot to treat my wife kindly and to give and receive love. That's a pretty good deal for a guy who misread the Welch's grape jelly glass. Nate, would you like to share?
Sure. ditto.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just to kind of obviously add on. And the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're not here to recreate the wheel, right? It's right here. This is our text. This is what we've got. And it works very well. I've never seen someone actually apply what's in our book to their lives and not get well. That's pretty good news. But I too, there was a point where I thought just the admission, the outward admission that I was an alcoholic was essentially my first step, right? Like, I'm an alcoholic. That's my first step. And come to find out, I heard someone talk about that from the perspective of when an admission is an outward and inward, right? It's a two-way thing. And had I really conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic? No, right? It's like the movie ticket. Admit one. It's going to let you. Two let in, right? And that's what I need to do, is to really have that experience, because it's amazing. It's amazing, actually, that we have this amazing set of tools, criteria, to test for alcoholism. Do you have it? Do you need to be a member of our fellowship? Do you need to move forward? Because if not, let's not waste any of our time, right? I mean, if you're not alcoholic, don't waste your time with going through the steps. It's probably not going to touch anything. And in fact, you'll probably just be just as good off without it. I've known people like that. No one that's ever been led into my path has ever been qualified for alcoholism, and I've never found out that someone is not. By the time they get to us, usually, you know, they're in the right place, that's been my experience. And again, because then there's also the other situations where we see a lot of that. I mean, we live in 2016. There are so many things that people are using and addicted to, and drinking and drugging and this, that, and the other thing, by the time they get here a lot of the time, that it's important, I think, for a lot of the time, for us to be able to understand the difference. Because I have absolutely met individuals that became physically addicted to a substance other than alcohol, but they don't have alcoholism. And that was kind of a trip for me to consider. How could you be physically addicted to a drug? You look like me, you kind of act like me, but you don't have the soul sickness that I do. Which is, it's, right? I mean, just, it blew my mind the first time I actually realized that, because for a long time I was just, a drug is a drug is a drug is a drug, and if you do drugs and if you do alcohol, you must have what I have and do what I do. And the reality is that I come to believe that's not necessarily true, right? Do I know a lot of people that use drugs alcoholically? 100%, right? And that's the beautiful thing, because by the end of a qualification of a first step, myself and others that I work with are able to say, wow. Like, I've literally seen people come in thinking they're drug addicts, and by the end they're like, I'm an alcoholic. I had no idea. Like, that is me to the T of what's going on in here, right? The soul sickness, and I'm not here to stir up a pot. It's really, I don't have that much of an investment, and I think it's just important for us as alcoholics, if we're going to be of maximum usefulness to God's children, to be aware that, you know, it's not all thrown into the same pot, essentially, right? So, powerlessness over alcohol, and the fact that there's a dash in the middle of that step is just such a beautiful thing. And what this would look like tangibly for me, when I'm taking through the steps, is that we would review the first half of the first step, right? Review my powerlessness over alcohol, what that looks like. And for me, that's, what did my relationship with alcohol actually look like? I mean, we have a ton of information in this book, right? First 43 pages, plus, you know, doctor's opinion, all about the first step, right? And I remember the first time I was taking through the steps, not like, you know, this is what this meant, and this is what they meant when they said this, and I was like, are we doing it right? Right? Like, just me talking up here and not going line by line and explaining the book, that freaked me out at one point in time. It's like, whoa, what are we up to here, right? We're supposed to work out of the book. It's kind of a weird place for me to be, where that was all I knew. I knew how to teach. I knew how to teach out of the book. I knew how to be about the book. But what I was lacking was an actual personal experience with what was actually laid out in our text. I didn't know that. And I certainly wouldn't admit that out loud. But what happened to me is that I was given the opportunity to take a thorough look at that. What did my relationship with alcohol look like? And I talked about that a bit last night, but of course we have all the factors, right, that are outlined in the pages, in the first 43 pages of, you know, mental obsession, right, physical compulsion. I have this allergy to alcohol, where not everybody that drinks alcohol has the same reaction that I do. I have this underlying spiritual malady. And the strange mental blank spot that precedes the first drink. Someone that doesn't have alcoholism is not going to relate with any of that. And as a side note, I think a fundamental understanding of the text of the Big Book is essential, right? I mean, to just say like, oh, you could come in and never have an understanding of the book, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying once you get that baseline understanding of what's in this book, There aren't many hidden tips and tricks in here that will come out at the next big conference kind of thing, right? But for me to just use this for what it was intended to do, and that be to change my life, is much scarier than going and learning more, right? I don't like to dive in to where this leads me, because it's scary. Especially when we cross that dash that our lives had become unmanageable, right? Because as I sit here today, of course, that portion of the first step for me looks much different than it did the first time I was taken through the steps. I mean, I was like, obviously, right? The first time I had an experience with that, I was just like, my life is in absolute shambles. I mean, I'm still shaking. I've still got booze in my system, practically. And so it looked a lot different. And for me, and it's been talked about thus far, to be who I think I am in Alcoholics Anonymous and have a vulnerable experience with this at least once a year, not my favorite thing, right? And I've actually, and I've done this myself, and I've watched others as we're, you know, walking through it. You know, when we review these bedevilments, I mean, that is by no means an exhaustive list of unmanageability in the ways that it could come up in our lives, but it's a pretty good start, right? Those are pretty good questions to start with, and if I can answer yes to a few of those, chances are the rest of them are flared up as well, has been my experience. When I answer those questions honestly, because I've definitely looked at these and said, not really, things are all right. And I love it when people say that to me, because I'm like, no, they're not. Let's get honest here, right? Let's not waste either of our time. Let's talk about this, right? Because what's the point? Like, if these aren't active in your life, again, why do we need to move forward, right? Why am I laying down another layer? Because that, for me, that's what really, everything that I strive for in Alcoholics Anonymous is essentially towards surrender. I mean, if I could really drive it to one word, it would just be surrender, obedience, discipline. These words that just make the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Those are like the top three words I never wanted to hear ever again when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Surrender and obedience and discipline. Oof. That's the, you know, the hand coming out of the sky. It's going to bat me around. I recently heard an example of that. It was talking about, when I hear the phrase the wrath of God, that scares me to death. I think that's the worst thing ever, because what I apply that to is that God wants me to suffer, right? That's just, I don't know if everybody processes it that way, but that's how I see it. Like, the wrath of God means that God's going to come down and make me suffer. And I heard this broken down by Peter in a podcast, actually, and it was broken down in a way that made so much sense to me. The wrath of God is essentially when God steps aside and lets me live my life alone. That makes a whole lot more sense to me, and it doesn't make me nearly as resistant or defensive, right? Because I don't think God wants me to suffer. I don't think God has laid out, you know, pitfalls and booby traps for me to fall in and teach me lessons. I think a lot of the time I'm so stubborn and so locked into my ways, and I only learn through suffering and pain, that at times God's like, I love you so much, but I'm going to step aside and let you take yourself out here, right? And I don't necessarily mean literally, physically, with alcohol. Sometimes I mean that just in my life. If I'm dead set and locked into making sure my plan goes a certain way, the wrath of God is essentially for me to get to the bottom of that barrel on my own, right? I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that breakdown of that, because it just made a lot of sense to me in a way that it's what I live with, right? I mean, and I'm aware of that. That's the fact. Like, I'm at a place most times where I can't even be resentful at God anymore, because I know it's not his fault. Everything that goes wrong in my life, I've created. If I'm going to be honest, I can track back to where my plan started to be set in motion. And it's like, how fair is it that when things fall apart, it's God's fault? When things go well, it's my fault. It's my doing, right? I want to take the credit for the good. God gets blamed for the bad. And a lot of the place, if I'm being honest, that's where I'm at, right? But with the first step, too, again, every year that I look at this, I'll have the opportunity to share. What does my powerlessness over alcohol look like? Does it change much on a year-to-year basis, that first half of that first step? Not really, right? I mean, that's the one part of our stories and of our beings that's pretty much there, right? We're not really developing any new experiences or a new relationship with alcohol if we're in here and we're sober. But the reality is I need to be reminded of what it is that got me here in the first place. Why am I here? What qualified me initially to have this wonderful seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, to spend the weekend in Conyers, Georgia with complete strangers who will now be friends, right? I mean, it's a pretty good deal. But for me, oftentimes I want to just pretend like it's not relevant, right? I'm sober X years. Yeah, I get it. But I'll tell you, like, just having the experience of being able to say in my own words, because to have an interactive experience, what's in here, and I just can't, that's like the theme of my life, is to have an experience within me to transfer what's in this book into my being, into my soul. That's when things started to shift for me. Because I had maxed out my knowledge. I had learned so much. I've thrown away like three different big books that I had prior to this one because there were so many highlights and underlines and ragged pages. At one point I wore that like, you know, if somebody would ask me how I'm doing or, you know, how long I've been around, I'd hold up my big book. Like, look how weathered this thing is. Clearly, you know, I've been around for a while. and that's a joke, you know, obviously, because it's not a good indication of what I'm doing. And in fact, for me personally, there were many times where I hid behind what I knew to avoid what was really going on inside of me. And I say that because there is no greater painful place that I've come into contact with in Alcoholics Anonymous where I'm feeling some way that's completely different than what I'm showing you. And I've been there. And I've been there. There was a period where I don't remember exactly how many years, but I'd gotten to the point where I had made the decision internally that I was never going to tell anyone the way I was feeling internally, right? I was just going to continue to try to be Mr. AA for everyone around me. And the time came where I literally was so soul sick, so bankrupt internally. I'm talking, I couldn't lay down at night to try to go to sleep without having earphones in to just try to drown out the noise. That's how loud the voices and the discomfort and the disconnect had gotten in me again. And it took me, it literally just took someone who was honest enough with me to say, what is wrong with you? Something is wrong with you. You're not your normal self. And it was like the floodgates opened up, right? I shortchanged that always. The power of objective and loving conversation with another man, with another woman. I mean, it's amazing. And not to say that I need to be, laying on a couch somewhere just talking about my problem, because that's not necessarily a solution either, right? If I'm not bringing truth into the picture with the hope that God can curb the course of my life currently, I'm just talking about it. I'm just talking about it. And for me, that's just not a, that's not a corrective measures type of path. And so the good and the bad news is that we're all really screwed one way or the other. And that's kind of been my experience, is that at the end of every, and like I said, literally contemplate that first half. And what it'll usually be is I'll review and get honest about that first half of that first step, and then spend a week in consideration with that piece of the first step, to just, again, admit inwardly, right? To be is the hardest thing if you're like me. I want to do. I want check boxes. I want worksheets. I want execution. I want to do. I want to go through the steps in an afternoon and move on to go save that herd of people over there, right? But the reality is, a lot of the time, I'm shortchanging myself of that process, that internal transformation that happens when I'm able to experience this book in my soul with God. And I mean, I scoffed. The things that I believe work today, there was a period where I would just, wow, lame. I wouldn't even have believed it, right? It wasn't until I absolutely drove myself into the ground that I was willing in a different way. Just my experience. I've never once been the person that says, you know, you've got a really good point. Maybe I should change the way I'm doing things. Nope. It's not until I absolutely just drag on the bottom for a period before I'm willing. And I mean, I don't even know when that is a lot of the time. Because I try to surrender my life to God every day. Every day. I mean, that's the only way I can have a life worth living. Everything is a paradox in here. It's just so confusing. I literally have to die to self to be reborn in God and to have a life that's worth living. The cost of my life, as it said, is my life. And I'm thinking, and these are like, I was talking with Nathan before breakfast, and he asked, is Nikki always that like gentle and kind of docile? And I said, absolutely not. Let's just clear that up right now. He's, not to pick on Nikki specifically, but when the truth needs to be told, the truth will be told, and that's kind of the point. And for me, to not have a sponsor in my life that's willing absolutely to poke where it hurts means I'm just basically sponsoring myself. I want a sponsor that will sit in front of me while I sponsor myself and just drive on down the road into the ground, essentially, is where I'm heading, right? I need a sponsor that's not going to agree with everything I say. I need a sponsor that's going to take the other person's side in a lot of instances, right? There have been many a times where I thought my sponsor liked my wife more than he liked me. And I say that jokingly, but it's the truth a lot of the time, because I'm in the wrong, and I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm in the wrong. But if we're going to make any kind of progress, we have to. What was the story? And I'll go back to it, but the story of the Emperor's New Clothes. Is that even worth telling?
Story of the Emperor's New Clothes. So everybody is like sucking up to the Emperor, and he's got this tailor in there who's just like supposed to be all that and a bag of chips, and they're all oohing and aahing. And the fact of the matter is, the guy's standing there stark naked, and oh, the clothes are beautiful. And somebody walks in and says, hey, the Emperor has no clothes. And that's the thing, we dress ourselves in our own illusion, and somebody could just poke a hole in it. It's not we go around bapping on other people. It's not that. We've got enough experience in ourselves to know how we carry this illusion, and we help somebody else to see through that illusion.
Right. I just think that's such a great thing. Are we going to stand in the room and compliment each other on our outfits that don't exist? Or are we going to tell the truth? I just love that. I love that story. It's been that's trickled downhill a lot. Everybody in the greater New England area knows that story by now. But I just think it's so relevant, right? Because I am, whether I want to act like I'm just the toughest guy on planet Earth, I will absolutely go the easiest road. I do not like conflict. I don't like to be abrasive. I don't like to think that I could say something that will change someone's opinion of me. I don't like to tell the truth a lot of the time is what that really comes down to. Do I? Yes, I do. Because I love the people that I'm in touch with enough to hurt their feelings and to curb their opinion of me, right? And I'm grateful to have someone that does that for me. Because that's what it really comes down to. A lot of the time it's that objective viewpoint of my life. Like, what is actually going on here? I mean, I have a pretty good idea what I think is going on. But as we've talked about at length, I mean, my mind is just... It is a booby trap in itself. It is. I can spend no significant period of time in my own mind formulating a plan, and I don't know if anyone else can identify with when there's unknowns in life. Who loves the unknown, first off? Yeah, no, nobody in this room, right? We just freak out when there are gaps in the story. But what my mind does is it fills in those gaps, and that's dangerous, right? Because I'm filling in the gaps with what suits me best, with delusion usually, right? Because if the story is unknown and I'm not sure if someone likes me, the narrative that my head comes up with is they hate you. They hate you. They can't stand you. That's why they're not talking to you, right? Or whatever the case, you know, like go on down the road with the examples. But my mind is pre-programmed, the default mode, to say you suck and ain't, let's gather evidence to support that, right? That would be the story of my life. Gathering evidence to support why I don't deserve anything worthwhile in life. And that's just such a defeating mentality, but most of the people that I'm connected with feel the same exact way. Go figure, right? We all hate ourselves, but we can't admit it because we're just too proud, right? So to learn to love myself and through God has been one of the most challenging things ever, right? And it's not something that I did it, check the box, I worked the worksheet, I'm good to go. Because again, you know, when we get back to that second half of that first step, what does that look like for me current, real time? You know, and Mickey read through the bedevilments. But I would encourage anyone that hasn't had an opportunity to kind of review that in an intimate setting, be vulnerable with God. Go sit somewhere quiet and really spend and have an opportunity to ask yourself, where am I really at if I ask these questions and give honest answers to myself, right? Am I struggling with any of these things? Because inevitably, I've never been able to read through these questions when it's my time to go through the steps and not have yeses. Just not the case. Does it look like it did when I first came in? Of course not. Does it look different? Again, we get much more creative and manipulative in our agendas to control our lives. This past year for me, it was mostly my career, my marriage, right? My role in AA. Those were the biggest areas of my life that I was still scared to death to let God manage. I just don't trust that he's going to do it in the way I need him to, right? So I try and try and try to make sure it looks the way that I want it to. I have a horrible pattern. When I get afraid, I try to make that fear go away and essentially make it 10 times worse. I don't know if everybody can identify with that, right? My conflict resolution means more conflict, right? Like, when I do something that makes my wife really angry, I get mad at her for being angry with me. But I can't identify that I actually caused the fight or the squabble in the first place. She's like, Nate, you're in that crazy place right now. Just walk away. We're not fighting right now. Just walk away. I'm thinking, just validate me. Tell me I'm a worthwhile. You know, like, I'm in that place where it's so easy for me to shift. First and foremost, the criteria and the measurements that I use to measure my self-worth are off the scale in the wrong direction a lot of the time, right? I look to things. I look to people. I look to my wife. I look to people in AA. I look to my job to validate who I am as a human being and prove to me that I'm worth something. the truth for me at this point in time is the only validation that actually matters and that will actually hold true is that of God. I can seek validation from God, and it's the only validation that matters. Everything else is just smoke and mirrors. And to not have the opportunity to be vulnerable, right? To put my AA superstar hat over on the shelf, and honestly, it doesn't even exist. I'm not a superstar. The reality is that my head wants me to think I'm something bigger than I am, and I couldn't possibly have flaws still. It's the biggest lie we'll ever tell ourselves. I am just as broken, if not more broken, than I was when I first came in. Because the scars that a lot of us have on our souls, they go, I mean, way, way, way back. So when I come out of an inventory and I'm thinking, why isn't this gone, right? I wrote inventory about it. Isn't that the magic wand, right? And the answer for me a lot of the time is that, of course it's not, right? I mean, when you heal something from the inside out, it can be a long journey, right? And the willingness to lean on God in those times of discomfort, in those times where I just have no idea what I'm doing, I just feel so scared. That's where the growth happens. It's in that discomfort. It's in that being, right? And when I have, again, that time to really consider and get honest with God and ask myself these questions, that's a pretty good indication of where I'm actually at. And inevitably, beyond what I initially talked through with my sponsor, things always come up during that week when I'm spending time with God in consideration and meditation that I'm just like, wow. Oh. And I thought I'd surrendered, right? And that's it. It's like the vulnerability is really the key for me, and to have the opportunity to be vulnerable. I don't like it. I hate it. Like I said last night, I'll probably say it 20 more times throughout the course of the weekend. It's my least favorite thing, to look like I am broken, right? Because I want you to like me. I even want my sponsor to like me, right? I don't want to like actually look like I need some help. But the reality is that's short-lived for me today. My threshold for pain is so low. I mean, it doesn't take much, and that's a blessing. So,
thanks, Nate.
Yeah.
The gift of desperation. I've had people react like, hey, man, you're 42 years sober. Are you still going to meetings? Do you still have to go to meetings? Right? Because they don't understand what we're doing. But... the fact of the matter is that it's not alcoholism, right? It's alcoholism, and I live with it. I'm just as alcoholic today as I was when I came in here. I am just as alcoholic. There's no mojo on this thing. And there's many... how deep is the rabbit hole? And, you know, do you guys use that expression, peeling the onion? For years and years and years now, I have gone through the steps formally every year. And what's interesting about that exercise is it's not like an examination of last year. When I start to go through the steps, it's life and death right now. And I'll go back to stuff when I'm 7 years old. And it's just whatever appears. So... I read in a book one time, the snake sheds its skin in its season. Okay? If you rip the skin off that snake, you could kill it. We are impatient. Okay? So we're going to wrap here in just a sec. I paint religious pictures. Okay? But I paint them like out of the 13th century. It's just very stylized. They're called icons. If you have any acquaintance with the Orthodox faith, these are icons, and I paint them. In the history of icons coming along, it was always like the Christ figure on the cross was above the moment, okay? It's kind of like almost floating off that cross. And there was, in Latin, an occurrence where the Christ figure on the cross was suffering, and it was called in Latin Christus Patiens, P-A-T-I-E-N-S. What does that word look like to you? What?
Patience.
So it turns out that patience means suffering. And if I am impatient, I am unwilling to suffer. It's kind of cool, huh? I'm impatient. I'm not willing to suffer. I'm not willing to walk this road. I'm not willing to have God have my skin slough off in my season. Because I got to get out there and do this thing. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? So the first step, if the first step is not in place, I will not have a program. Because what I'll do is I'll step right from the first step into management. Right? And now I'm going to manage my program. I have two experiences that really helped me with powerlessness. I had one of them coming here. I was at 31,000 feet in an airplane, driven by somebody else. And what's going to happen? We may experience occasional turbulence, but what does that mean? Upside down? I don't like flying. Why? Because I'm out of control. So you see what I mean? We have that indicator. I also ride a motorcycle. I'm telling you, at 70 miles an hour on a motorcycle, brother, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Right? So here we go. So there's powerlessness. Now the illusion I have is that I have power right now. I don't have power right now. I don't have power any time except what God gives me. And the longer we hang out with the stuff, the deeper that realization can be. Does it mean we can't do a job or be married or be a friend or play a game of softball? We can do all of those things. But it works better if we pray. So, in all cases, at all times, the first step applies. I never outgrow the first step, ever. Now, there are schools of thought that say, oh, yeah, man, once I do this stuff, I now have power. Not going to happen. I will be given power. Why don't we take a break and we'll get back together at 10:10. No?
We're 10 minutes past schedule right now.
Well, if you're going to rewrite this thing, to hell with it.